Genetics is the major systematic force making us who we are as individuals. If you had been mixed up at birth in the maternity ward and the wrong parents, not your parents, took you home and raised you, what I'm saying is you would be much the same person you are now, as much as identical twins are similar to one another, even if they're raised in different families. Instead of thinking about parents as making their kids into something they want them to be, it's to say, to recognize that kids are different, that you don't have as much control because half of it's genetic and the half that's environmental is probably random. You don't have those levers to pull either. You really have very little control over how your kids turn out in terms of individual differences. Don't think so much about making your kid into something you want the child to be, but rather to give your kids opportunities to find out what they like to do and what they're good at, and then to help them do it.
I thought we might start with a story and a little bit of history. And the story you mentioned in passing is a story I believe you encountered when you were in Boulder, Colorado in the 1970s, when the view, as I understand it, in psychology was very much, if not totally, a blank slate outlook. That was what academia was teaching. That's what people in our culture had thought influenced people. You told a story in passing in our first conversation about women who were in Boulders who were hippies at that time, sort of coming out of the 60s, and they didn't want a husband. They didn't want a male partner. They wanted a child. They had adopted this view that children were blank slates. And so they were going to random bars to get pregnant with men they didn't know and didn't plan to have a relationship with, and how you that mortified you.
Yes.
I'd love to set the table with giving people some historical perspective on how much our view, academia's view, and culturally our view of human nature has shifted in those 50-ish years. And if you could recount that story one more time, I think it would interest people in why you found that such a crazy act, given what you know now about genetics and its influence on people.
Yeah, I wonder if that doesn't also sound crazy to most of your audience now.
Yeah.
Because things have changed a lot in these 50 years. But a less bizarre sounding example of that is adoption. You know, I ran into and still do run into people who spend their life not getting pregnant, having abortions, but then later in life when they've settled down, get to their late 30s or something, then suddenly they find they can't get pregnant. And so they think about adopting. And a lot of people still really think, as I said last time, it's just TLC, tender loving care, that DNA has little to do with it. And I don't know, that we talked last time about this important, the view that most people have of how important parenting is. And we talked about parenting matters, but it doesn't make a difference. But that is a less bizarre example of the same point, that people might think, you know, at a conceptual level, yeah, sure, there's Uncle Harry who had this particular problem and that was sort of inherited. But when it comes to their lives, including understanding themselves, especially, I think, people don't really take into account how important genetics is. So you could go back more than 50 years. You go back 100 years, though. Well, in the turn of the 1900s, the late 1800s, Galton, Darwin's cousin, thought about Darwin's work in evolution. And, you know, Darwin intentionally avoided talking about humans particularly and inheritance, whereas Galton, you know, took that bull by the horns and said, you know, what if there's so much genetic channeling to make species different or breeds of animal, it makes sense that some characteristics of humans are also going to be heritable. So he developed the twin and adoption method, and it really took hold in the early 1900s, but then Galton's considered a bad name now because he coined the word, he not only coined the phrase nature and nurture, but also coined the word eugenics. And by that, EU means good genetics. And at the time, most of the intellectuals, you know, the Bertrand Russells and people, all thought that seemed like a reasonable thing to do, to foster good breeding, you know, which we all do in a way. I mean, people who are abhorred by the concept of eugenics, they practice eugenics in the sense that assortative mating, you know, the correlation between spouses. If you've gotten single and you go to a singles bar and you're looking for a mate, you might not know it. And you might think it's hard to measure intelligence, but you're measuring their intelligence, you know, fairly accurately because the correlation between spouses is about 0.5. So you think so that's a type of good breeding in a way. You're affecting breeding. So I'm not going to defend eugenics, and because especially then, of course, once you got into the 20s, psychology became very environmentalistic with behaviorism. So behaviorism is the idea, let's get away from this philosophical stuff about introspection, and let's talk about observed behavior. And we know we can change behavior externally through rewards and punishments, mostly, you know, in animal studies, but you know you can change behavior. People learn. But then they thought that that's all there is. You can change anything. You know, the famous dictum by J.B. Watson in 1928, give me a dozen babies and I'll give you bakers and thieves and bankers, you know. He never believed that, by the way, completely, because it goes against your own experience. But environmentalism really took off then in the 20s in psychology, because you can do something. You know, you can shock a rat and make it do something. So psychology became very environmentalistic. It didn't have to be environmentalistic because it was behavioristic. But because of external contingencies being used to change behavior in all the learning sort of psychology, it just became very environmentalistic, thinking that's the way it all works. We are what we learn, basically. And that was really reinforced by the early 30s with the rise of Nazi Germany. And that, of course, made eugenics a very bad word and, you know, continues to be to this day. And that made even the mention of genetics in psychology verboten in the 50s and 60s. And then by the 60s, psychiatrists, I think especially, with schizophrenia and major psychiatric disorders started almost, they were almost compelled toward a more balanced view. They knew this wasn't all environmental. And so the first adoption and twin studies were done, and they were suggesting very substantial genetic influence. But then even into the 70s, psychology itself was still not just agnostic about genetics. It was really a very strong antipathy. So when I started graduate school in the 1970s, by chance, I happened to end up at the University of Texas at Austin, where they had the only behavioral genetics program in the world. And we were required in those days to take courses for a couple of years. They assume you don't know anything when you go into graduate school in psychology. And so you take courses in all the major areas of psychology, which I think is, you know, a good thing to do. But at Texas, and only Texas in the whole world, you had to take a course in behavior genetics. I mentioned last time the important role of chance. Well, a good example for me of chance is that I ended up at Texas, not because of this behavior genetics program. It was just a pretty good psychology program, but also because I was an inner city kid, poor kid. They paid me money to go there. So that, from an inner city Chicago point of view, was a no-brainer. So I went to the University of Texas, and just by chance, I had to take this course, and then in behavior genetics. And it still really puzzles me. There are 40 second-year PhD students in that class. It floored me. I just thought, man, I'd never heard about genetics as a psychology undergraduate. And suddenly you see from mostly animal studies, but also the beginnings of human studies, like I mentioned with schizophrenia, I thought, man, this is really powerful stuff. How is it possible I never heard about it? So I was just completely flabbergasted. You know, I mean, I just knew that's what I wanted to do. Yet 39 other students took that course. Not one of them went on in behavior genetics. So what is that about? And I think that's this other topic that we didn't really get into last time. Luck is the where I think most of the environmental influence is, in the sense of, we mentioned stochastic, idiosyncratic sorts of unpredictable experiences, which I summarize with the word random. And people looking back on their lives can tell stories about it. But I think most people in their cups realize there are these sliding door moments, like me going to Texas and just happening. If there wasn't for that program, I never would have been in behavioral genetics. I wouldn't probably have heard about it in the early 70s. But then the other thing that's interesting about the environment is, in addition to this non-shared environment, these non-systematic effects that are, that's not nurture, it's not systematic effects of the family. The other major finding about the environment from genetic research, which we only learn because if you don't take genetics into account, you can explain everything environmentally, which is what people did. We talked a lot about weight last time. Weight runs in families, no problem. Parents give the kids their environment and role models for healthy eating and exercise and all of that. It made a lot of sense. But once you realize their parents and offspring and siblings are 50% related genetically, then you start saying, well, maybe it's genetics. And then it turns out it's all genetic. That is, the familial resemblance is genetic, but the rest of the variants, you know, we said heritability is about 50%. The other 50% isn't nurture. It's this non-shared environment. And then the other thing I was getting to is that because we looked at environment in genetically sensitive designs, we began to see, kind of an interesting story how this came about, but by accident, I did an adoption analysis of an environmental measure, chaos in the homes, which is one of the better predictors of cognitive development of children, always thought to be environmental. And because I stuck it in this adoption design, it was coming out genetic, you know. And then you think, how could an environmental measure be genetic? We also did this with television viewing, which really irritated people because that's the quintessential environmental measure used in thousands of studies. You know, we're in a renaissance of it, more with social media than just television viewing per se. So then you start thinking about it, though, and how is it possible that environmental measures show genetic influence? Like, take the simplest one of all, books in the home. That's also a pretty good correlate of kids' cognitive development, reading development in school. And they say, well, yeah, it makes sense. It's environmental, the correlation between how many books you have in your home and how well, say, you read when you go to school. But if you got the message from last time that everything's genetic, you said, how could that be genetic? Well, it becomes obvious, right? The books don't get on the shelves by themselves. Who has a home with a lot of books? Parents who like to read, parents who are more highly educated. So then the genetic hypothesis looms large, that the correlation between parenting, say, books in the home, in this case, and outcomes, like how well children read at school, isn't at all necessarily environmentally causal from the number of books in the home to how well you read. It could be the other way around. Some kids just like to read, and so they ask their parents to read to them and like to have books. But the point I'm making here is the third hypothesis. When you get a correlation between X and Y, everybody supposedly knows that correlation doesn't imply causation. So it doesn't mean X, parenting, causes Y, children's outcome. It could be Y causes X or a third factor that accounts for both. And that's what I'm talking about here, the third factor being genetics. So that parents who like to read, have books in their home, probably encourage their children to read. But the children then learn to read more readily, primarily for genetic reasons. So the one thing I'd really like the audience, because we didn't touch on this last time, I'd really like them to keep in mind is that when you see a correlation like that, a week can't go by where I don't read something in a newspaper trying to freak out young parents by saying, if you don't do this, your kid's going to be screwed up for life. Or if you do that, it's all over for the children's development. You know, and that's so wicked because there's rarely any evidence for that. And almost never do they take genetics into account. So I just like the audience, whenever they see one of those correlations, just to say, what about genetics? Parents and offspring are 50% related genetically. You just can't ignore genetics. So that was a very long-winded answer. Sorry, I haven't really talked to anybody today, so I'm afraid you're going to suffer from a little verbal diarrhea here.
So I wanted to have you on. I think from the first conversation, one of the lines that really stuck with me and other people that I talked to about that interview was, and I got a lot of head nodding from friends of mine who are parents, and I think even my own parents about this, about how, you know, most parents are nurturists until they have their second child and they begin to see these amazing differences between two people who are genetically similar, but and are raised in the same environment, but end up being very different. I believe I heard you say this in another podcast interview, that one of the most heritable personality traits is shyness, and that a lot of parents will explain away why one of their kids is shy. They'll say either, I took them out too much as a child, they had too much social interaction when they were young, or I didn't take them out enough, I should have taken them out enough to make them more sociable, and now they're extremely shy. Not factoring for, I think it's something like the 60 to 70% heritability component, which again is not 100%, but it's a big percentage of how much that personality trait is heritable. I'd love to have you either confirm that or add anything to that you think is relevant to, especially any parents that might be listening to this.
Yeah, I think you sort of missed the punchline there, though, and that is that when you have your second child, because the first child is extreme, say very shy, the second child's only 50% related genetically. So the chances are they won't be as shy.
Yeah.
And so the way this aphorism comes about, that parents are environmentalists until they have more than one child, is that you see that second child who's so different, and whatever you did the first time around, took her out too much or didn't take her out enough, you say, I didn't do that. This, you know, with the second one, I'm pretty much the same. We do pretty much the same stuff. So you begin to see just how different these kids are. Even though they're 50% related genetically, they're 50% different. And so we didn't talk about this last time, that genetics predicts that kids in a family will be different. Because they're only 50% different genetically. The problem with our socialization theories in parenting is it really does assume, you know, it's the same parents, so maybe they treat the kids a little differently. But basically, if a parent's very authoritarian, they're going to be kind of pretty authoritarian with both kids. So most of our environmental theories, especially like with obesity and weight gain, they assume that the family environment's making kids similar. But they're wrong. What makes them similar is genetics. The environment's important, but it doesn't operate in that systematic nurture way.
I want to give, to me, at least in my very amateur exposure to this world, the center of the bullseye that got me interested in a lot of your work and the work of genes and the power of genes and its influence in who people become has been these amazing identical twin studies, and especially the identical twin studies, which I know you've said is very rare, of identical twins who are separated at birth. I came across in researching this interview the story, which I had never heard of before, the Jim twins from Ohio, born in the 1930s. And then I heard you talk about, I believe it's the Minnesota study that was systematically following identical twins who were separated at birth. And you have spent decades of your life doing these studies with adoptive parents. And I know initially when you were in the 1970s, women who were giving up their kids and for adoption, usually from religious homes, and then going back to their normal lives because they had gotten pregnant very early in life. If we could talk a little bit about these identical twins and what just some of the stories that are so fascinating and what you take away from these identical twins that really were separated at birth and then come to know each other. I've heard you talk about the Three Identical Strangers documentary as well, which is fascinating. Anything you'd like to note about that that you think is interesting or relevant or important for kind of highlighting the key theme here of the power of genes and its influence on who people end up being?
Yeah, that's great. We didn't talk that much about it last time. And you mentioned Three Identical Strangers. I'd really recommend that people look at that. It's a documentary that won Sundance a few years ago, and it's available on streaming services. And these are three identical twins. So I didn't mention last time, identical twins are genetically identical. If you sequence their DNA, you get the same DNA sequence because they come from a single fertilized egg. So sperm, egg, zygote. They're the same person, but then in the first few days of life, it splits. So you get two genetically identical individuals. And one, so that's about 1 in 1,000 births or something. But 1 in 10,000 births, one of those splits again. So you get identical triplets. And that's what this is about, three identical strangers. Because on top of that rare occurrence, they were all adopted separately at birth by an adoption agency in Brooklyn who didn't tell the adoptive parents about the existence of the other two. And that's the last half of the film. That's ugly. That's a rogue psychiatrist who wanted to use this to prove it's all nurture. So he put the three identical twins in as different homes as he could find. One, an immigrant home that they ran a small shop. Another, a high school teacher, and the other family was one of the wealthiest families in Long Island. So he was going to show, you see, it's all nurture. He never published it, though, because what did it show? It's all nature. These three guys, it started because one of them, one of them, Bobby, who's the rich kid, went to university in upstate New York. And on his first day at school, this Bobby, everyone was calling him Eddie. And he was looking around to see, oh, this must be some psychology experiment, you know. But he very quickly met Eddie, and it was just obvious, as it shows in the film. I mean, these guys are just so identical, you can hardly tell them apart. And so the publicity that came from that, I mean, they quickly said, what's your birth date? You know, it became clear. They were both adopted from this adoption agency, so they clearly were identical twins. He didn't need to do any blood testing because these guys are so identical. But the publicity came up with another of these identical triplets. And then they got together, and a lot of this is in the film, and it was just amazing. From the moment they met each other, they were like rolling on the floor with each, you know, wrestling and playing, goofing around. You know, it's just amazing how similar they were. In personality, they're all kind of outgoing. Some weird anecdotes, like this is relevant to like the Jim twins and the Minnesota studies too. They're just some amazing anecdotes. All three of them were very serious wrestlers. Wrestling? You know, we don't even have that in England, but in America, you know, a lot of high schools, I think, have some access to wrestling. So how is it they could all get into wrestling? They're raised in these very different families. And the answer is they look like wrestlers. You know, they're all kind of stocky and short, but, you know, muscly. And it always appalled me to think just about who wants to grapple with sweaty men, you know, but they just loved wrestling. They also interested me intellectually because you don't see this in the film, but I know this is true, that they're the type of student I like. They just didn't like academia. They didn't like being told what to do, what books to read or whatever, but they all were very intellectual and bright. So when they got when they finally got together, they all dropped out of university and set up a nightclub in Manhattan called Triplets. And it made $1 million in the first year. And so that's an example of this other thing I was trying to get at, is what we call the nature of nurture, genetic influence on the environment. It's genetics, you know, the most highly heritable cognitive trait is vocabulary. Hmm. And people say, what? You know, you have to learn vocabulary. But that misses the point. You know, it's some people learn a lot more vocabulary than others. And that's part of what I'm saying here is, you know, if you ever tried to, like, study up for SATs or something and you try to memorize words, it really doesn't work. You know, the only way you really get those words in your head is by using them in context. And some people just are really tuned into that channel, whereas others, you know, aren't really. And that's an example of how we use the environment to foster our genetic propensities. If you've ever seen musically gifted kids, you almost can't stop them. You know, you don't have to give them the best teachers. You can't stop them from humming and thinking about music, hanging out with other kids, and now with Spotify and that sort of thing. There's just no stopping them, you know, kids with musical ability. So this is the topic of the nature of nurture. And I think you see a lot of that with these identical twins reared apart. Even though they were in different environments, they still use their environments to foster their genetic propensities. And in genetics, we call that genotype environment correlation, in which you select environments and modify them and even create environments correlated with your genetic propensities. You make your environment. So this is an active approach to experience. It gets away from that old stimulus response learning psychology thing where the environment is out there that it happens to you. You know, you're passive. You're like a rat in a cage and you either get shocked or don't get shocked. The environment just doesn't work that way in psychology. We are our environment. We create it. And it's such an importantly different way of thinking about how the environment affects us. So just to summarize here and to bring it back to the three identical strangers, you know, that film, my book Blueprint, I plug my book here, is sort of making three major points. One is that genetics is the major systematic force making us who we are as individuals. Heritabilities are about 50%. That's not 100%. The environment's important, but it's not the environment we thought was important. It's not nurture, systematic effects of the family environment. Whatever it is, it's making two kids growing up in the same family different from one another. And after 30 years of research trying to identify those non-shared environmental influences, I've come to conclude that they're mostly random in the sense I described it before, unpredictable, stochastic, idiosyncratic. And then the third kicker, which we've just talked about here, is the nature of nurture. That is, what looks like environmental influences are genetic effects in disguise. So correlations between parenting and kids' outcomes isn't proof of environment. You've got to control for genetics. And when you do, you find out those correlations are mostly genetic, mostly because genetics is the major systematic force making us who we are as individuals. So what this means is that I'm saying that if you had been mixed up at birth in the maternity ward and the wrong parents, not your parents, took you home and raised you, what I'm saying is you would be much the same person you are now, as much as identical twins are similar to one another, even if they're raised in different families. So it's not really just hypothetical, though, because we have these identical twins reared apart. And the thing about the Minnesota studies and the Jim twins, we could talk about the Jim twins. They're the ones, one was raised in a kibbutz in, is that the one in Jerusalem? And the other was raised as a Nazi youth?
I'm not sure if that's the one or not.
There is one like that. Yeah, maybe that's a different pair, but there are these remarkable anecdotes. But the problem is, like, you know, what they did in Minnesota is they found out about all these twins and they they just advertised for twins who had found their co-twin. I think the Jim twins are the ones in Florida, where one guy from New York went down to Florida and suddenly everyone seemed to know him. And then he came to realize that there was this identical twin and they had been adopted apart early in life. So what Minnesota did over like 20 years is they brought these twins together as soon as possible after they had been reunited, and kept them for a week and got something like 50,000 pieces of data on them. And what they emphasized is the remarkable coincidences. I don't know if it's the Jim twins or another one of those, where their hobby, it's a bit like the wrestling I mentioned before. Their hobby was to do carpentry. Okay, well, lots of people do carpentry. But the carpentry they like to do is to build circular benches around trees. Now, how many people in the world like, you know, would say, oh, that's what I really like to do. But they both like to do the same thing. And, you know, the weird circumstances like types of really liking one very odd type of toothpaste. And you have to go to great lengths to try and get it. But here they are, two separate people living different lives. They both did that, you know. But the problem with that is those are anecdotes. And if you and I went to Minnesota for a week and got 50,000 pieces of information, I bet you we would find some amazing coincidences between you and me. So the way it is, the plural of anecdote is not data. And so there have been systematic studies, and we did one in Sweden with over 150 pairs of identical twins reared apart from early in life. And the reason we could do that is in the early 1900s, there was a severe economic depression in Sweden, which was then almost an entirely agrarian society. And so they had lots of kids, and a lot of women were dying in childbirth. It was really dire times. So a woman gives birth to kids, the husband, farmer, says, who wants them? You know, you don't have to take both. You just take this one and you take another one. But the cool thing was in Sweden is they are very good record keepers. And so we were able to go back then. And these are people born in the early 1900s. So it was one of the first studies of aging. You know, what about genetic contributions in aging? So we had the cover of Science of these separated identical twin women at the age of 92, and we got them to give us photographs going back to their childhood, you know, but completely separate, right? They didn't even know about the existence of the other. So that really is impressive stuff. And the Minnesota study would highlight the anecdotes, but they were finding that identical twins reared apart are almost as similar as identical twins reared together. And as I mentioned last time, there's some evidence that for personality, they're actually more similar than identical twins reared together, which could be because they're not pushing off of each other, trying to say, oh, you're the athletic one and I'm the academic one, or, you know, or you're one thing you do find with identical twins reared together is one becomes the ambassador. So in childhood, you'll often find that when the twins meet someone, there's one who's kind of the ambassador who does the talking. But that does switch as they go through life a bit. But that's an example of how they might, by living together, they might actually make themselves more different than if they had actually been adopted apart. So identical twins are very dramatic evidence for the importance of genetics. If you said you had a friend who was an identical twin, and you mentioned that they were different, and especially in personality, but you also then agreed that, standing back a bit, what's amazing is how similar they are.
I actually knew two growing up, and it's funny you bring up that ambassador idea, because in both there clearly was one that was the social one, was the, sort of the spokesperson for the twins.
Right. So the one thing I didn't mention about the Three Identical Strangers film is that although all the photos of them are very gregarious, outgoing, laughing, joking sort of guys, in fact, they were actually very depressive. And You don't see that so much in the film, but it turns out that all three of them, as adolescents in the 50s, had been sent to for they've had counseling for depression. Now, nowadays, that wouldn't be a big deal, but in the 50s, that would be a very big deal. And to have maybe the wealthy one, you might say, yeah, you know, they're all doing psychiatrists or something. But all three of them, including the lower class one, went for counseling for their depression. And then during the filming of this documentary, one of them committed suicide. So that's the sad part about this. But it's, again, remarkable that that they were all depressive. And again, it might seem like an anecdote, but all of this is backed up by these systematic studies I was telling you about. And it fits with the rest of the twin literature. When we say the twin study, we compare identical and non-identical twins, and it fits with the adoption data. And all of these studies have their own problems, but to get such different designs to converge on the same conclusion is the best evidence you can have for the importance of inherited DNA differences.
Yeah. I've always wanted to ask you about that film and those three men. And as I remember that documentary, it is the perspective that I remember the film making was that, if I remember correctly, the immigrant father, the lower middle class dad, was this loving, gregarious man who was
Bubala, they called him.
Exactly, who was very loving to his son. And when he found that there were two more of them, he became almost a surrogate father to the other two. And I thought the film was trying to make the argument that the twin who ended up killing himself had a more authoritarian dad who was featured in the film. And yeah, that was the rationalization they seemed to be giving as to why his psychopathology took him to those lengths. And I wanted you to comment on that, what your takeaway was from that film.
Yeah, that is just so wicked that they did that. And I know a bit about the director, Wardle, and he was kind of pressured into making it more. I mean, the first half of the film, where you're just looking at the, you know, objective data about them getting together and how similar, was a very strong nature story. So they wanted to spin it into nurture. Hmm. And so the guy was the Dave, the middle class kid. His father was authoritarian, high school teacher. He had been in the military. But what was so wicked is, I don't know if this came out after the film or whatever, but the father was, you know, really broke down about this. He really felt he was doing the absolute best he could do for his kid. There was no evidence he abused the kid, he, you know, punished him physically or whatever. They just took this hook, authoritarian parent and suicide. And, you know, you just say, that's like environmentalism gone mad. But I think it was worse than that. I think it was just something to hang nurture on, you know, say, well, see, nurture's still important, you know. But that is really, was really very, very bad. That one case. What if it had been Bubala? His son had committed suicide. Then what would they do? You know, so that's really bad. But it's a good example of how environmental stuff just gets by with a nod because it's what we all expect. So I wonder how many people watching the film would raise the question that you're raising. Wait a minute now. How do we know just because this father was more authoritarian than the other father? How can we say that caused the son's suicide? I mean, because there's nothing the son ever said that said, well, I'm committing suicide because my father was very authoritarian. You know, I mean, there was nothing like that. So that's really wicked and an example of where environmentalism can really go bad. We think environmentalism's good, but actually I think there's more wickedness done in the name of environmentalism than in genetics by far. Because a lot of the environmentalism was mother blaming. Why is your kid schizophrenic? You don't find out till they're in the late teens, early 20s. It's because of what you, the mother, did in the first few years of life. You can't change that now, you know? And it's so wicked because it's wrong. There's no evidence for that. And that's why parents of children who grew up to have psychiatric disorders are big supporters of genetic research. And even there, I hear people say, yeah, well, sure, they want to get off the hook. And my point is, there's no hook. They don't deserve to be on a hook because it's wrong. It's not what they did in the first few years of life. So there, so I vented that now.
I'm really glad you clarified that, because I've always wondered what the more honest take should have been on that film. I mean, the dad whose son killed himself clearly held himself essentially responsible for his son's suicide, and is seen crying in the movie. And I think this gets to a larger point that we, I think, touched on a little bit in our first conversation, but it's one I wanted to bring up again with you. And I heard you, just in researching for this conversation, talk about that your main message for parents in looking at the data about how children turn out is to relax. And I want to transition to have you comment on that very idea, because you've used the word wicked a couple times in this conversation. I know I've heard you talk about how popular culture and media preys on the fears of parents, that they have total control or majority control over how their kids turn out. I just want to put that to you and open up this conversation as to how you think a modern, informed, sane parent might think about the role that they have once the child is born and who they become. I started the conversation 4 or 5 months ago in our first chat, that you have this famous line that parents matter, but they don't make a difference. I just want to put that to you and get any comment you may have on those general ideas.
Yeah, well, as I said last time, those, I think it's 7 pages or something in my book, got more attention than everything else, because it matters to people's lives, whether you're the child and you're thinking about your parents or whether you're a parent. And it's such an important message. As I said last time, if there are any parents out there who think kids are a blob of clay, they're going to mold to be what they want them to be, please read my book, because it's not going to work, and it's going to be counterproductive. And so what I'm basically saying, I think people respond to it very readily, I think, you know, even though it's a big leap. Instead of thinking about parents as making their kids into something they want them to be, it's to say, to recognize that kids are different, that you don't have as much control because half of it's genetic and the half that's environmental is probably random. You don't have those levers to pull either. So you don't have nearly as much control. You really have very little control over how your kids turn out in terms of individual differences. And that's a good thing if your child is one of the 1% of the population that's diagnosed as psychotic later, because we think about it as credit, you know. Your kid turns out to be this great, athlete or musician or whatever. But it goes the other way too. And, you know, it's pretty heartrending to get these emails from parents who say, you know, I did everything I could and it was all going great. And then suddenly it goes bad and, you know, they feel terrible about it. What did I do wrong? But the thing is, they didn't do anything wrong. So the positive message here is to think of yourself as a resource manager, to say, don't think so much about making your kid into something you want the child to be, but rather to give your kids opportunities to find out what they like to do and what they're good at, and then to help them do it. And yeah, that bit about what they like to do, I think that's important. The appetites are as important as the aptitudes. You know, it's a virtuous circle. We like to do what we're good at, and we do more of that, and we get better at it. But it's just such a simple thing for parents to grasp. And I think it's changed a lot of parents, the way they think about child rearing. And it's important to me because You can make your child, you know, it doesn't mean you can't do anything. That's what I tried to emphasize last time. If you want your kid to be a basketball player, you can do a lot to make them a better basketball player. But are they going to be elite? You know, if they're not tall or they don't have the coordination, it's just not going to happen. So you can make a difference, but there's a cost to that. You know, like Erickson's 10,000 hours. There's only so many 10,000 hours in life. Hmm. And if you're pushing your kid in a direction they don't like, eventually they'll just say, screw you, I'm not doing this. I knew I'm not good at it. I made that mistake with my kid. I just thought to be a civilized person, you ought to be able to read music. So I made them take piano lessons. But because they're my kids, they're ornery. And because I wanted them to do it, they said, no way am I going to do it. So it really got to loggerheads, you know. And I was trying to do good by them, but I was enforcing my view on them. And they liked music, but they just didn't want to have a music teacher having them play the notes as written, you know. So they rebelled against that, and eventually I gave up. But in the meantime, I think I did damage our relationship for a while. And you got to think of that cost as well. You know, you think you're just doing something good for your kids. You want them to be very successful at school. But with that 50% difference between you and your kid and between two kids that you have, that means some kids, you know, it's the hardest thing for university-educated parents to have a kid who just doesn't like school, isn't good at school. And, you know, we've got to be more accepting of that, and especially in terms of education, where I think that golden yardstick of going, you know, university education, years of education, I think is mistaken. And a good example with me is my sister and I. My sister had trouble at school. She didn't, you know, do well at school. She didn't like school. Whereas I learned to read. We had no books in our home. And this is an example of the nature of nurture. Back then, we had public libraries, and I would go to the library even at 5 and 6, and I'd bring back a wagon load of books, and I'd just read everything. And I loved school because it was easy. You know, I got rewarded for it and got scholarships and all of that. And my sister, on the other hand, you know, what's wrong with you? Your brother is doing well at school. And she ended up doing quite well. She liked doing fine sensory motor sorts of things. And she ended up being a lab technician in a hospital and became head of a blood lab. And, you know, she saved a lot more lives than I did, that's for sure. And she loved it. You know, she loved the people she worked with. It was a great job for her. And so I think parents just really need to realize that their kids are different from one another, and to respect those differences, and to do stuff for your kids because you love them and you want life to be nice for them. You know, I often use the example of if you tried to pick a partner and you said, well, if, you know, she's okay, I can shape her up and I'm going to do this, I'm going to give her these courses, or I'm going to have her go to opera or something, so I'll make her into a better person. You know, you don't do that with your mate, do you? And I think it should be more like that with your kids. You do stuff for them because you love them and you want life to be good for them. And especially, I think you give them opportunities to find out what they like to do. And the bottom line here, I think, is parents should relax, as you were saying. But part of that enjoyment is watching your child become who they are rather than trying to make them into what you want them to be. It's a simple lesson, but I guarantee a lot of parents out there who are reading these child-rearing books that are very dogmatic, saying, you must do this. But then if you look at enough of these, there's thousands of these books, you'll find one that says the opposite thing. And Oster, I forgot her first name right now. She has this book called Crib Sheet. She was an economist who, when she became pregnant, decided she'd really kind of look at all these parenting books out there and realize that there's very little empirical basis to them. They're dogmatic in the sense, you know, it's by Dr. So-and-so. And but then it's terrible for psychology, because if you then look at other books, you'll find them saying just the opposite thing, just as dogmatically. So Oster at the end says the only thing you can tell parents to do vaccinate your kids. That's the only thing, you know, that is absolutely clear that it will be good for them. Everything else, it depends so much on the child. You know, like, what do you do if your child doesn't sleep? It just depends who that child is. And because parents are 50% related to those children, I think they have a better shot at knowing the individuality of their child, being sensitive to it. So I think genetics is the most important thing that parents need to know about child development. Yet these thousands of books rarely even mention genetics.
And yet it's one of the most uncommon phenomenon in this world of parents, or I should say there are plenty of parents who are having children because they want a carbon copy of themselves. It's almost the truth of a lot of what we're talking about to me seems like the ultimate test of loving someone, of accepting their nature and cultivating a life that, as you said, would make for a nice life for them. There's a quote I came across that I wanted to read in watching one of your interviews preparing for this conversation, which is, quote, "Children are not to be molded, but people to be unfolded," which I think summarizes a lot of what we've been talking about. And I wonder if you have any other closing comments. I mean, the amount of suffering that occurs in this world because of parents historically and currently wanting their children to be a certain way, to have a certain personality, to have a certain disposition, and trying to force their kid to be what they want has to be one of the biggest sources of misery in this world. And I wonder if there's any other, before we move on to any other, some other subjects today in this conversation, if there are any other closing comments you might have. I mean, theoretically, this all makes a lot of sense to me. I don't have kids personally. My brother does, and I can already tell my nephew as a three-year-old has a nature that is just there and probably will be for the rest of his life. But it's, if you have a child that's difficult or has a learning disability or, you know, is not attractive or is socially difficult or has autistic tendencies, it's, I guess, to speak to the parents that whose kids have been dealt a difficult hand, that their kids aren't necessarily sweet and loving and sleep well at night and intelligent. They're difficult. How you might think about how those parents should deal with those kids, and even for prospective parents. I mean, to me, having a kid seems like the ultimate roll of the dice because there are no guarantees. To me, it seems like the ultimate leap of faith and the ultimate loving act. If you really want this for your life, because of the randomness of what, how your child might turn out. But any other closing thoughts on this? I would love to, you know, give you a platform to talk
well,
about.
Well, a lot to say. But you know, one of those bolder women became my wife because she was like a super mom. She died after a bicycle accident, a long story in itself, but she wanted just to have a kid and we were living together, which is fine, but I was very busy being an academic and I really didn't want to have a kid then particularly. So that's great because I really want to raise this kid, you know, but then she had this accident. And so I, had to, raise this kid from the age of two or so. Wait, what was my point there, though? About sorry, I lost the train there. That there's a lot of emotional.
I'm sure
to that. But where were we going?
Well, I was asking for what advice you might give to parents or prospective parents that. You know, and that is a good example of finding themselves in a situation where they, you know, are now a single dad or a single mom, and they are having to navigate. Mm. You know, given, I guess, what I'm really asking for is the wisdom from all of your research of how you would frame that to prospective parents or to current parents about, especially with kids that are challenging, that are not these superstars that all parents believe their kids are going to be above average, which by definition is unusual.
It isn't
how you
like
think
Wobegon.
About that? Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think just by being aware of genetics, I've seen it help parents to understand kids are different. And sometimes that means some kids are going to be more difficult, like ADHD. You know, I would have been diagnosed ADHD if they had the diagnosis back when I was in school. But then to realize some of these things are maybe difficult as children, but maybe they're advantageous. You know, energy level, I think, is a very positive thing later in life. And so I think just recognizing and respecting the genetic sources of individual differences between kids helps parents just to realize it's not their fault and they might as well go with the flow. They can change some things. As I said last time, you know, if a kid's aggressive, you don't accept that as a parent. You know, so I'm not saying you just throw your hands up, say there's nothing you can do. But pick your battles carefully and mostly don't think you're going to mold the child to be the way you want them to be. But I just wanted to close by thinking about it the other way around, which people haven't talked about as much. That is, we all had parents. And there's an increasing trend now for people our age to blame everything wrong in their life on their parents. But actually, can you see the flip side of this is it's probably not true. And recent research, some of it done at our place here at the Institute of Psychiatry in London, ACEs, what is that? Something. Anyway, it's like terrible things that happened in childhood. And if you asked people retrospectively about it, you know, they'll say, yeah, all these terrible things happened to me as a young person, and most of them have to do with their parents. But there are studies now, like in Dunedin in New Zealand, where they have good records about these things. And it turns out that objective indices of these acute experiences, these bad things that happen to young people, they don't seem to have much of an effect. But so I think what you're getting is this nature of nurture thing in terms of experience. People who are depressed now as adults, they look back and probably everything's terrible. Their childhood's terrible. But those perceptions probably aren't causal, really. So the stepping back from this, something that people haven't really said is the flip side of saying that parents matter, but they don't make a difference, is that when you're looking back on your life and blaming everything that's gone wrong in your life on your parents, I think this suggests you really need to think again because it's probably not true. Now, I know that's going to piss off a lot of people, but it hasn't been said before, and I think it is. It doesn't necessarily follow from what we've been saying.
I think this is a great segue to, and I heard you talk about this in another interview about how you're someone who generally has thick skin, and that was, I think, important to you in the 70s when you were fighting those battles, to talk about the role of genes in psychology, which is just this unending fascination of mine in that realm. And there's a quote I wanted to read out, which we talked a little bit before we kicked off this conversation, which might be a good segue here. And this is from your book, Blueprint, quote, "Genetic research shows that the medical model is all wrong when it comes to psychological problems. What we call, quote, disorders are merely the extreme of the same genes that work throughout the normal distribution." I'd love to give you a little bit of time to unpack what that means, again, to a lay audience, and why that idea matters.
Great. Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I don't think we really have touched on this. And I know it means a lot to some people. And so the general sort of the bumper sticker here is that the genetic architecture of psychopathology is very different from our current classification schemes. You know, we talk about the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, DSM, from the American Psychiatric Association. And it's all based on the medical model. And that medical model begins with diagnosing something properly, which, you know, seems to be a good thing to do. But it's actually very much oriented towards single causes, either single gene causes or single environmental causes. And that doesn't work when you get to common medical disorders as well as psychiatric disorders, where we said genetics is the major systematic source of those disorders, but it's by no means a single gene. And that means you move from a deterministic, hardwired phenomenon to probabilistic propensities, because there's so many thousands of little gene effects. So it's not like necessary and sufficient single gene mutation sort of thing, of which I said less than thousands of those, but they're very rare. Most of the medical and psychiatric burden in society comes from these common disorders that are influenced by many, many genes of small effect. And as a result, they are probabilistic. And another result of that is that they're not etiologically distinct. You know, we think, oh, I got get a diagnosis. And that means, oh, now I understand. I'm different from other people. I had a friend who called me it must be a year or so ago now, a middle-aged guy who says, God, I just wanted to tell you, I've found out what's been wrong in my life. I've just been diagnosed as ADHD. And I had to tell him, it doesn't mean anything. I mean, I've actually come to the view these diagnoses are really, they might make people feel a little better, put a label on what their problems are, but they're devoid of reality in two ways. One is their dimensions. When we get these polygenic scores for like ADHD or schizophrenia or bipolar depression, they're necessarily normally distributed in a bell-shaped curve. There's no evidence that people who pass the diagnostic criterion have any different genes affecting them. It's just they've got more of these genetic propensities. But it's normal. And that's good, because it means it's not us versus them. It's not us normal people versus those schizophrenics. It's all part of a continuum. We all have thousands of genetic risk factors for schizophrenia. It's just a question of how many you have. But it's quantitative, not qualitative. It's a matter of more or less rather than either or. So there is no disorder in the sense, in the medical model sense, of an etiologically distinct disorder. There's something that causes you, there's some simple single thing that causes you to have that disorder. And the second way in which genetics has really torn up the diagnostic manual is that it's a little harder to understand, but it's that the genes for one disorder overlap a lot with the genes for another disorder. So the two major psychiatric disorders, psychotic disorders, that is severe mental disorders, are bipolar depression, which a lot of people have probably heard about, and schizophrenia. Up until the recent diagnostic manual, it couldn't be both. They were the first dividing line in the nosology, the structure, the classification models. So they were thought to be very etiologically distinct. Yet when the first genetic studies were done, these genome-wide association studies that we mentioned last time, looking at these SNP chips that allow you to measure hundreds of thousands of DNA differences throughout the genome, well, the first studies were done of bipolar, and they found some genes, many, many genes really, of little effect that are associated with bipolar. But then they did a GWAS study of schizophrenia, and they found that most of the top hits for bipolar were the same hits for schizophrenia. The same genes were involved. And subsequent work has shown that the genetic correlation between schizophrenia and bipolar is not zero. It's 0.6, meaning that you find a gene for bipolar, there's like a 60% chance it's also going to be associated with schizophrenia, meaning these are large, there's a very large general genetic component. And whether or not you're schizophrenic or bipolar is more a matter of environment, maybe these random stochastic effects that we were talking about, than it is genetic. But the hot topic now is this P, little p, meaning general psychopathology, like little g refers to general cognitive ability. So there's a lot of what goes on with psychopathology is a general genetic propensity to maybe be disrupted by the stresses and strains of life, but they're general effects. They're not actually specific to whether you're schizophrenic or bipolar. It's the same genes that are involved. Now, there's some specific genes, of course. That's not surprising. But the surprise is that most of the genetic effects are actually in common. They're this general psychopathology. So those are two ways in which the genetic architecture of psychopathology is almost completely different from our current classification schemes. And so in summary then, they're dimensions, they're not disorders. And then secondly, the classification schemes we have for disorders really bear little resemblance to the genetic architecture underlying these disorders. So it's all a mess. And I think the main thing we need to do is to get rid of the medical model and to start over again and to start with symptoms rather than our preordained views of what psychopathology is. You know, if you ask about our psychiatric classification schemes, there's none that are based on etiology. It's mostly just historical. The best example, the worst example of that is autism. Why does autism have these three components, now two components, you know, of the repetitive behavior sorts of things, you know, like Rain Man, you know, the film. But then the other is sort of communicative problems, you know, like supposedly autistic kids don't look you in the eye. They find that uncomfortable, you know, for example. Well, who says those things go together? Who says there's something called autism? And the answer, in 1945, Kanner, a psychiatrist, just found some kids who had these characteristics and said, well, these kids are pretty odd, you know, and let's call that autism. It has very little, it has really not much more to it than that. Yet they become reified, you know, as real disorders. But, you know, back then, kids had to be very extreme to be called autism. But, you know, now with ADHD as well as autism and most other childhood disorders, they've been, the definitions have been broadened, the number of people, you know, maybe because people know about it, parents want these labels, you know, to make sense of their kids. But, again, probably irritating a lot of people who feel relieved to get a diagnosis. I just really ask that people think about what I'm saying, that I think there's no scientific value in these diagnoses that we give people, because there are no diagnoses. There are no disorders. I actually have a famous paper in 1990 called Common Disorders Are Quantitative, the Extremes of Quantitative Dimensions. And so I think it's a good example of how I don't think there's any scientific value to these. And some people say, well, but the whole system is psychiatric system and social work and insurance payments. Everything is based on these diagnoses. But is that a reason to perpetuate them? I think we need a revolution and say, I'm not saying there aren't problems. Definitely there are people who have problems. But what value is to be gained by putting this label on them that has no bearing on reality? You know, it can't be a good thing. And that means if there's no diagnoses, there's no disorders. If there's no disorders, there's no disorders to cure. We're not going to cure something. It's all quantitative. You know, we can ameliorate symptoms, but that can have nothing to do with causes. You know, causes and cures aren't necessarily related. So there's a real need here to disrupt the whole system and start over again, I think. And that's exciting, you know, from a scientific point of view. But also, the next time, you know, parents come to me and say, oh, God, you know, my kid's been, I understand, my kid's having trouble at school. They've got dyslexia. So that's what you do. You don't say, yeah, some kids have trouble learning to read. Right. That's a problem. Let's do something with that. But to make it a real medical model, you don't just say kid has reading problems. You say dyslexia. They don't have math problems. They have dyscalculia. You know, it makes it sound like more of a real medical disorder. But there's no evidence for that. And it's really misleading scientifically, and it's really screwing up genetics, I think, because we're pretending to be studying these distinct disorders. But really, most of the genetic variance is the same across them, and it just can't be the right way to go. So I'm trying to use this genetic research to help us get at the specificity of these problems. And so, again, I just want to emphasize, I'm not saying there aren't problems. There definitely are problems. Lots of people have problems. But what's to be gained by using the medical model to diagnose people and pretend that these are etiologically distinct disorders? I think that only misleads people. Hmm.
And I don't know how much you thought about this, but what in your mind would be a first step to a better model, or a, generally speaking, a better model for this area?
There are people trying to do this. That's going back to basics and saying, yeah, there are these problems, but let's not presuppose how they go together. Let's not suppose that kids who have these motoric problems of, you know, like repetitive things or compulsiveness where they need their slippers aligned a certain way at the end of the bed or they can't go to sleep, or that they go together with these other disorders. You know, the thing about it is, if you got one of those problems, it's bad. You got two of them, it's worse. And you got three, it's even worse. But that doesn't mean they go together. It just means, you know, that they'll get rarer and rarer the more of these things you require. But that doesn't make it a disorder. So what people are doing is they're going back to these problems with less of a classification scheme, mostly focusing on the symptoms, like the behaviors. What are the problems that people have? And they're trying to build it up from the ground rather than from a top-down sort of approach, which we've done in the past for just historical accidents in a way, you know. And so I think it's not going to be easy, but it's happening. And they tried to make it happen with DSM-5, the latest diagnostic manual. Because of this sort of evidence, they shadowed a quantitative approach. So instead of ADHD, say, where you say you need two of these, the kid has to be two of those and three of these and four of those, and then you call them ADHD. Instead of doing it that way, they're going to say, well, there are these quantitative measures of attention, activity level. Here are the ones you could use. And you could then have a clinical cutoff. You know, a lot of social services and insurance, they require to say whether a kid has it or not, which is a mistake, but even with a quantitative distribution, you could say, okay, above this level, usually for kids, 5%. That's why all these things, reading disability, ADHD, now even autism, they're moving towards 5%. And that's, I think, just because of practicalities. You know, if it was 1 in 10,000, there wouldn't be enough of them to make a deal about. And it can't be 20% because then that's so many kids. So it ends up, you know, back and forth, and they usually end up at about 5%, which is actually a sign of how arbitrary all of this is anyway. But you can draw a line there and say, okay, we know it's quantitative, but above this point, we'll say the kid has a problem we ought to do something about. And I would say, but then you should realize there's a lot of kids, you know, imperceptibly below that cutoff. But nonetheless, we could do that. So they did that with DSM, and what happened? It's vested interest, primarily insurance and financial reasons. People said, oh, no, no, we can't have this. We've got to have these medical diagnoses. So they actually scrapped it. This is like 10 years in the making, and in the last few years, they just scrapped this whole quantitative approach. But it will happen. It's inevitable as more and more people realize how bizarre this system is that we have. And I think genetics has played a big role in that. It's it's not the only piece of evidence, but, you know, working clinicians, they realize these things are kind of a farce. And what matters a lot is how people deal with it in their life. You know, you can have some pretty severe problems, but you can actually be pretty good at handling it. And, you know, is that a problem? No, probably not. So I'm actually excited about it because I think I'm not a psychiatrist, but and I'm more interested in cognitive development, but this area of psychiatric classification really seems to be a good way to go. And really interestingly, cognitive has always been kind of empirically oriented. We didn't have someone say, this is the way the structure of cognition works. You know, it's been pretty much built up from the ground up. You take these tests and some tests correlate with other tests more than they do with the rest of the tests. And so you get your group factors and then you get more specific factors. And then people realize there's this general cognitive ability, which we call intelligence, that accounts for maybe 40% of all the variants. And that's a remarkable finding. I think that, you know, you take tests that are very different, memory tests and perceptual speed tests and reasoning tests, they all correlate. It's called the positive manifold. And that's really mostly driven by genetics. And that's what we mean by G. So cognitive abilities has been built from the ground up empirically, whereas psychiatric disorders are historical, they're not ideologically, they're not empirically based. And we really need to do that.
Fascinating. So that's
good. God, I was really rabbiting on here, but thanks for putting up with me, Dan.
Anytime you want to come on the show, you are welcome. I know I know we're a little over time. So I wanted to close with maybe one final subject. I want to make a comment and then close with a final question. And the comment, you mentioned this company offhandedly in our last conversation. And I wanted to reiterate that for people interested in getting their own, I think it's their own polygenetic scores, which is a company based in New York, which I hadn't heard of, Nucleus Genomics. That seemed to be your recommendation for where people might want to go to get up-to-date, sort of state-of-the-art information about their own propensities, their own genetic information as detailed as is available and still relatively affordable. If that's correct, I'd love to know that, and feel free to correct me on that if there's something else you want to add there. But I wanted to mostly close and just sort of pull us back to a 30,000 foot view on how you think a wise society and a decent society should take all of this information, right? I mean, to me, the big takeaway, and this may even be your first law of genetics, which is that everything is influenced by genes. It's a huge component to why people are the way they are, why people turn out the way they do, and why people have the gifts and the difficulties in their lives that they often experience. How you think we should take that to heart in structuring an educated, enlightened, decent society that incorporates that into how we raise our kids and how we think about the opportunities we want to try to afford people in their life in dealing with people that disagree with us, you know, politically, temperamentally, we find hard to be around. This bleeds into everything in life. It's sort of right at the heart of, you know, in many ways, the humanities of how to think about what it means to be a person, why you are the way you are. And I just wanted to close to give you a forum to talk about this, because very few people have spent as much time thinking about and researching dealing with these issues as you have. And I have to imagine this is something you've given a ton of thought to over the years. And maybe we can close on that general topic.
Well, to be honest, what really turns me on is the science of this. Now, yeah. You're not supposed to say that, really. And it's great talking to you because, you know, you keep bringing in, well, what's the impact for humanity? And I've actually spent a lot of my career keeping my head down and staying out of those sort of the social implications and that sort of thing, because I just didn't want anything to interfere with my research. But now, after 50 years of research, I don't care. You know, I'll I like talking about those things. So from 30,000 feet, I think the thing we'll see is the medical area. There, it's a no-brainer that medicine is moving away from what this new book by Peter Attia, I don't know if you know.
Sure.
It's called, what is it?
Outlive.
Outlive, yes, right. And he talks about medicine 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0. And that 2.0 is you wait for something to happen and then you try and fix it, like you can do with infections and antibiotics. That was a big thing. But medicine 3.0 is preventative. And a big part of prevention is to predict. And DNA is the best game in town for prediction because you can predict at birth. We didn't really say this, but do people realize that the DNA you get in that first cell with which you began life is the same DNA in the trillions of cells of your body. So you can predict from the very earliest in life or at birth everything that can be predicted genetically. You can predict schizophrenia just as well at birth as you can at 50 years of age from the DNA itself. So it's the best. So medicine is clear about that. So that's why in the US, in the UK, for example, we have UK Biobank. And the neat thing in the UK is we have these electronic, we have the National Health Service, unlike the states where, you know, it's all state by state and it's hard to access these data. So we have 500,000 people in the UK Biobank with their medical records, but they've just started Our Future Health, which has 5 million people. I'm part of it as well, where you get you give your DNA and you give access to your NHS medical records. So medicine, it's just a no-brainer that if you take, you can predict cardiovascular risk. Now, again, it doesn't predict, it's maybe 50% heritable having a severe cardiac event, but so that's not 100%. And of the 50%, maybe we can predict less than half of that with DNA itself. But nonetheless, that's still a better predictor of whether you're going to have a heart attack than just about anything else, really. Mm. And especially at the extreme. So we know that there's something like 5% of the men walking around with something like a 20 times greater risk of having a cardiovascular event. So there are things you can do then to prevent that. And it's said that, I don't know where these numbers come from, but if someone has a severe heart attack, it's maybe 750,000 pounds all in. By the time you deal with the pretty advanced surgery you have to do, and then not to mention the loss in quality of life. So it's a no-brainer to say, if we could prevent one heart attack from happening, we're doing a good thing. But we can actually do a lot more than that. Because if you knew you were at a tenfold greater risk of having a cardiovascular, a severe heart attack in your 50s or whatever, you pay attention to the messages we all hear, eat well, sleep well, exercise. But, if that was you at risk, you'd pay more attention to that. But then you can escalate technologically. You can do whole body scans. There's a lot you can do to predict fuzzy arteries and stuff before you have the heart attack. And it's just got to be a better thing to do. So I keep my eye on the medical area because that's where it's happening. And really, when people, once you get your DNA sequenced, not just SNP chip, with 600,000 SNPs, but all 3 billion base pairs of DNA, that's all she wrote in terms of genetics. That's it. That's all you inherited. So once that's done, you can then use it for everything else, like to predict psychological sort of phenomena as well. So this 30,000 foot view really, for me, I have my telescope on the medical area because other areas will follow, and especially as the medical area moves away from the single gene disorders, where it's still pretty much stuck, fair enough, because in the UK now, they've just last month decided that instead of just genotyping newborns for 9 major genetic disorders, which is most countries, everyone thinks about, neonatal screening genetically. Ooh, how could you do that? But countries have been doing it since the 40s because there are some actionable single gene disorders like phenylketonuria that you can give kids a diet and avoid the severe mental intellectual disability that comes from that single gene disorder by giving them a diet low in phenylalanine. So there's those nine that most countries now screen neonates for. But now in the UK, they've decided to screen for 200. And what will happen eventually is Gattaca, you know, the 1969 film Gattaca, newborns will be whole genome sequenced so that anything that can be predicted and prevented early, you could do that. And China, it said, I can't really pin this down, but I've heard it from a number of people that part of their five-year plan is to screen half of all newborns in China with whole genome sequencing. And they get a lot of people in China, and that's 15 million a year that will be whole genome sequenced. And once parents see that you can dodge this bullet, you know, that something would happen, you could dodge that bullet altogether by being able to screen early, you know, parents will demand it. And in the meantime, wealthier parents will do it. And, you know, there's that kind of inequity that comes from that. But we're in a transitional period, and I find it very exciting. And as I said last time, you know, there's lots of people who will talk about all the concerns here, you know, like data breaches and, you know, invasions of privacy. But I am definitely a cheerleader for this because I can see much more good coming out of preventing problems rather than waiting till they occur and then trying to fix them, because we're never very good at that. If you've had a severe heart attack, you know, your life isn't all perfect after that. You know, there's a lot of loss of quality of life, I think, as a result of that. So I'm very excited about the future here. And that's why I wrote my book, is to give people the literacy to understand DNA and to be able to participate in these conversations. Because it's so great that you're having this conversation, and maybe we'll do it again. Because I really enjoy talking to you.
Dan. Me too. I enjoy both the conversation, and the research is fascinating too. I learned so much from it. And is it still the case that Nucleus Genomics, is that what you would still point people to, the company, if they're interested in getting their own DNA sequence? Is that your top recommendation? Yeah.
Yeah. I just think it's a shame. There's about 50 such companies around, but as I said last time, there's none that are doing it right, which is a crime, because they could do it right just as well as they could do it poorly. Like what they typically do is just take a few of the top hits and call that a polygenic score. Well, it is. It's polygenic, but it's like 1/10 as good as what you could do. So it'll eventually be straightened out, but Nucleus Genomics is a place that will do that. And if you had $600, I think that's what it is. They'll do whole genome sequencing, which is kind of cool, because if you get that done once, that's all you have to do. You got it. And you could, anything that happens in the future, you could actually then use that. You wouldn't have to do it again because you've got your whole genome sequence. So it's worth exploring. And what I like about them is that they actually help you interpret it in reasonable ways, you know, because as we were saying last time, it's difficult to understand risk, you know, and even for a single gene, let alone for these highly polygenic characteristics. But all of this will shake down, and this will eventually be available routinely when you go to the hospitals, as they do in Finland and Estonia now. You go to the hospital, they take blood, they ask if you want them to do your DNA testing. And then they'll only tell you about things that are actionable, but that's an increasingly large number of things. So I just think it's all really exciting and terrific. And this is all in the last decade, you know? So I just hope I can hang in there long enough to, I never thought things would come this far, this fast, you know, in the 1990s. Note the human genome sequence wasn't sequenced, and we didn't have these SNP chips, and whole genome sequencing was just, that was only in the last 15 years that it really became a possibility. And then the cost went down from 10,000 down to now a few hundred bucks. So It's just been, I don't think there's any area of science that's advanced as fast. And especially, you know, when you think of in the 70s, here I was in graduate school, never hearing about genetics to where we are now. It's really kind of mind-boggling that it's all happened so fast. I feel very lucky to be there as all of this is happening.
An incredible honor. Okay, Robert, great to see you again. Thanks for the work you do. Thanks for staying up late in London for me.
Keep on talking.
Will do. Great to see you.
All right. See you. Bye-bye.